Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. You can listen to all our episodes on Podbean, Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. Enjoy. Inflation has become a hot topic of discussion over the last year, with governments across the world investing heavily in support for businesses during the COVID pandemic. A large amount of money has been borrowed and created through the process known as quantitative easing. This has led to fears of a rise of inflation, with the latest Office of National Statistics data suggesting inflation rose to 2.5% in June, up from 2.1%. This has led to speculation as to whether the Bank of England may increase interest rates and if politicians see inflation as a threat or a temporary blip. But what actually is inflation? How is it caused? Is it dangerous? And what policies can control it? With me to discuss this today is the Institute of Economic Affairs Economics Fellow, Julian Jessop. Okay, so first of all, Julian, what is inflation?
Well, inflation is a measure of how the cost of living is changing. So when you hear about inflation being, say, 2%, that means that a typical basket of goods and services that that people are buying is 2% more expensive now than it was a year ago. In other words, that's the annual change in a measure of prices. Now, there's a big debate about how best to measure inflation. For example, most inflation measures don't include house prices. Some people think that's a mistake because obviously housing is one of the biggest things that people spend money on. But house prices themselves are a measure of an asset price, like, for example, a portfolio of equities or a pension pot. They're not necessarily a stream of goods and services in themselves. So it makes sense to exclude house prices. But you probably would want to include the cost of owning a house. So that might be rent or mortgage payments. And of course, also the cost of things like electricity bills. If you're owning a house and have to pay those sorts of bills, that should be in the measure. But generally speaking, the inflation measures the sorts of things that we buy more regularly than housing. So that's things like, you know, food, fuel, but also services, everything from, you know, haircuts through to cinema tickets and things like that. So in short, inflation is a measure of how much more expensive the things that we need are from year to year.
Okay, so what typically causes inflation?
Well, the simplest answer to that is that inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods and services. But there are lots of different parts of that. I mean, the first part is, how do you measure money? You know, what measure of the money supply is the most relevant to determining inflation? It's not just about the stock of money, it's also about how quickly it's changing hands. And then the other aspects of that, if you look at both the supply and demand for goods, obviously the demand for goods depends, you know, largely on how strong the economy is, on people's incomes, more recently, of course, whether or not they're able to spend money at all because of COVID restrictions. And then on the supply side, there are lots of different factors that are important. For example, there might be shortages of particular things for one reason or another. So the prices of those goods might be might be rising more than others. On the services side, a lot of the cost element there is determined by the cost of labor. So if there are shortages of skilled workers, that can push up inflation as well. So while it's quite simple to say that inflation is caused by too much money chasing too few goods and services, there are lots of pieces of the puzzle that determine how strong inflation is at any one particular point in time. And there are other factors as well, sort of institutional factors. For example, you know, what prices are being set by the government, either directly or indirectly, for example, through indirect taxes. And also whether there are things like wage and price indexation and the role of expectations. So if lots of prices are set depending on what's happening to other prices in the economy, or very dependent on what people think is going to happen to inflation in the future, that can have a big say on what inflation now is as well.
So for those associated with the free market movement in the early 1980s, many associated high levels of inflation with a high level of money in the economy, as you've alluded to. So that means the supply of money was so great that prices inflated. This was known as monetarism, But is inflation increasing now because of money supply associated with quantitative easing? Or is it down to an increasing cost for certain raw materials, other factors such as reopening of parts of the economy that were dormant during lockdown?
Well, arguably, that's two ways of looking at the same thing. I personally think the right way to look at inflation is to focus on the money supply as your starting point. And when we've had a period like we have recently, when the money supply has been growing very rapidly, partly because of what central banks have been doing. So, as you know, they've been undertaking this policy of quantitative easing, which is basically printing money in order to buy government bonds. So that's increased the amount of money in the economy. That's a little bit out of fashion. It's quite striking how rarely even central banks mention the money supply now. It hardly appears at all in, you know, commentaries from central banks, including the Bank of England, but also the Fed and even the European Central Bank. I think most people tend to look at it the other way. They look at almost a bottom-up approach. So they look at those prices that are rising the most at any particular point in time and argue that those are driving inflation. Now, I personally think that's a danger of, you know, missing the wood for the trees. It so happens that prices are rising relatively quickly in particular areas where there are supply shortages. But if those supply shortages weren't there, then prices would probably be rising more quickly in other areas instead. So those sort of supply side factors, the, you know, disruption to the supply chains that we're seeing at the moment, for example, might determine where the inflation shows up. But it's basically the strong monetary growth over the last year or two that is driving up the overall level of prices and therefore driving inflation. So it's still, I think, the money supply numbers is the place to start.
So that's an interesting point. But I think, you know, if we delve into quantitative easing, because some people listening will be like, well, how can, you know, the government just create money? It's down to a theory of what modern monetary theory, isn't it? Do you think you can explain, you know, how do banks create money as they have done to finance, you know, huge amounts of state expenditure during COVID?
Well, the first point to make is that there's nothing intrinsically wrong about quantitative easing. The position we've got to over the last decade or so is that official interest rates have been cut to extremely low levels, basically to zero, and they can't realistically be cut any further. So if central banks want to stimulate the economy through monetary policy, instead of affecting the price of money via interest rates, they've had to increase the stock of money by essentially just printing more. It's always been the case that most money is created by the banks themselves, rather than by, you know, the sort of old-fashioned, you know, notes and coins that used to circulate. So that's nothing new either. The way that the Bank of England in particular creates money is what it does is it buys government bonds from private financial institutions, and it pays for them by crediting their accounts at the central bank with money that the central bank has just imagined up. So basically it's adding numbers to an electronic record of how much money commercial banks hold at the central bank. So it's not money printing in the sort of physical sense of, you know, the printing presses whirring and more notes and coins being generated. But what the central bank do is effectively creating money by just adding numbers to people's bank accounts. But that has a knock-on effect on the amount of money circulating in the rest of the economy, and therefore it pushes up the broader measures of the money supply, which in many countries has been growing by sort of 20-30% over the last year or so. That hasn't yet fed into very high inflation because the speed at which that money is circulating around the economy has slowed sharply, partly as a result of the restrictions on economic activity because of COVID. But there's basically a big overhang of additional money that is there either to drive much stronger economic growth in future or to push up prices, or perhaps some combination of the two. So there is a risk that even if quantitative easing hasn't caused, you know, huge amounts of inflation yet, it could do so in the future as the economy starts to run into capacity constraints as it rebounds from the COVID shock.
So what effects will inflation have on the average worker? Because some have erroneously said, you know, inflation will increase wages, and it's about time that people are paid a bit more. You know, and it's therefore a win for workers. Why is that a non-starter?
Well, the problem with that is it assumes that wages rise at least as much as prices do, which of course isn't necessarily going to happen. In order for people to benefit from higher prices, then wages have to rise even further than prices, and there's no obvious reason why that's going to happen. One of the many reasons why inflation is damaging is that lots of people's incomes are not in fact protected against rising prices. So when prices rise, the purchasing power of their incomes tends to fall, and that's a particular problem for some of the most vulnerable in society. It may well be that people in positions of strength, the relatively well off, might be able to benefit and have their incomes protected, but lots of people won't, and so they'll actually see their purchasing power fall as a result of higher inflation. At the end of the day, the only real way to get wages up, at least in real terms, is for productivity to improve. And that's not necessarily something that inflation helps with, if anything, because inflation disrupts the economy, complicates spending and investment decisions. Higher inflation can hold back productivity and therefore be bad for real wages. So when people say that rising prices are good for workers, they're making a really strong assumption there that wages will rise by more than prices, which there's no obvious reason why that will happen. The bigger risk is that lots of people get left behind because the prices that they face rise, but their incomes don't.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that shows a divide as well between the public and the private sector, in the sense that the public sector can bargain for higher wages, whereas many in the private sector can't. So what ways can policymakers control inflation? Is it simply within the power of the central bank, so the Bank of England, to raise interest rates, as you alluded to before, or are there other tools that policymakers can use to control inflation?
Well, ultimately, inflation is about the money supply or monetary variables. So there's a lot that central banks can do to control inflation. In the short term, it is difficult to control inflation because there are lots of shocks, and even though the Bank of England's remit is to target 2% inflation at all points in time, realistically, there will tend to be undershoots and overshoots because of shocks. And if you do get a shock, for example, like a surge in global energy prices because of disruption to supplies in the Middle East, then you will get a spike in inflation. I think it's reasonable to expect the Bank of England to look through that. But in general, if you can keep the growth of the money supply broadly under control, then inflation will remain under control as well. Now, in terms of controlling the money supply, in normal times, you would tend to do that through interest rates. More recently, because interest rates are already close to zero, then it's become more an issue of the quantity of money, and that's about quantitative easing. But if the Bank of England wants to keep inflation under control, then the obvious thing to do is a combination of reducing the amount of money it's pumping into the economy through QE, and perhaps putting on the brakes a little bit further by nudging interest rates up a little, not necessarily a lot, but the current levels of interest rates in the UK, just 0.1%, are unsustainably low, and I think a small increase will be justified.
So if interest rates do rise in the future, as you've alluded to, it slows down the economy. It increases interest on debt and investments, and thus incentivize saving. But is this a dangerous policy to pursue, considering that homeowners will see increased costs in the monthly bill, and businesses will see interest on loans increase? At such a fragile stage in the economic recovery, will a Bank of England interest rate rise damage the recovery?
Yeah, well, I think two key points there. I mean, first of all, the context matters. I think the Bank of England would only be raising rates or scaling back QE in an environment where the economy is stronger than expected and when inflation is stronger than expected as well. So it's a question of, you know, swings and roundabouts. I think a small tightening in monetary policy in those circumstances is not going to derail the economic recovery. The second point is that we need to think not just about the short term, but also the long term. I mean, yes, if we continue to pump loads of money into the economy in the short term, the recovery would be, you know, even stronger than it is now. But that would have costs because it would mean that inflation is likely to be higher in future, that there'll be lots of excesses in the economy. There might get asset price bubbles and so on. So sometimes it's worth slowing the economy a little in the short term in order to produce a stronger and more sustainable recovery in the long term. Because if we did allow the economy to overheat and inflation become a big problem, then we could be storing up bigger problems for the future.
Do you personally see inflation as a temporary problem which will pass? Or do you see it in the Hayekian sense that, you know, once the tiger is out of the bag, it's hard to get back in? Because I mean, there's a bit of a divide. There's no consensus. I mean, there was a consensus that, especially in the Bank of England, that this is a temporary thing. We don't need to worry. But some people are looking on and are concerned that long-term inflation will steadily increase and increase and increase.
Yeah, I am more worried here than most commentators, including the Bank of England, seems to be. There's a tendency to say that, you know, inflation is transitory and therefore we can ignore it. But I don't think that can be a get out of jail free card for central bankers for a number of reasons. First of all, I think there's a danger of focusing too much on the individual prices that happen to be going up the most and finding excuses to explain those away. Put it like this, if you strip out the prices of everything that's going up, then inflation is always low by definition. And I think you're missing sometimes the bigger picture, which is that, as I said earlier, there's too much money chasing too few goods and services. And, you know, that is the key driver of inflation. As far as the increases in prices inflation being temporary, for a start, those sort of transitory factors seem to be, you know, larger and longer lasting than anticipated. So even if you do believe that inflation is transitory, it does matter whether it's 2% or 5%, because even if inflation subsequently falls back, the level of prices is going to be permanently higher. And that is what really matters. And then the final point is that even if something might be temporary or transitory to begin with, it can become embedded in the system in some way. For example, through inflationary expectations, you know, we've had a long period when people have got used to inflation of around about 2%. But if inflation of, say, around about 4 or 5% becomes the norm, that starts to get sort of priced into the system. You know, people start to expect pay increases of 4 to 5%, you know, customers expect prices to rise that much, businesses expect to be able to increase prices by that much. So you move from a position where inflation at 2% is the norm to a position of where 4 to 5% is the norm. And I think that would be damaging. Very few people are talking about inflation going back to sort of 1970s levels of, you know, 10 or 20%. I think there are good structural reasons in the global economy why that's unlikely to happen, you know, at least the huge amounts of additional competition as a result of globalization and also lots of technological progress. But a period where inflation is consistently 4 to 5%, I think would be damaging. The inflation target in most countries is 2% for a reason. That's a low and comfortable level of inflation. But if we consistently start getting 4 to 5% from year to year, I think that would be a big problem. And there is a danger in being complacent about inflation in the short term that it does become embedded in the system, as I say, and they're much, much harder to get rid of.
Can you delve into modern monetary theory a bit more? You know, it's quite a key concept when we're talking about quantitative easing and inflation. You know, what's the next step with that?
Well, just a little bit more about something you mentioned earlier, which is so-called modern monetary theory. Yeah. This is hugely trendy, but frankly, I don't think adds very much. If the only observation of modern monetary theory is that governments or central banks can print lots of money to fund spending, then that's, you know, that's nothing new. I mean, that has always been the case. I think, though, even the more sensible modern monetary theorist people would recognize that creates dangers for inflation, that if you do print loads of money and the government spends it, then that can push up prices and be damaging to some of the people that you might want to help the most. The only real difference between modern monetary theorists, I think, and if you like, more mainstream economists, is that they see that as a problem that needs to be dealt with through fiscal policy. So they would argue that the additional money being pumped in by governments and central banks should be drained away through tax increases. Whereas others would say that actually you shouldn't have printed all that money in the first place. But the net result is you end up in pretty much a similar position. So under modern monetary theory, you get loads of money being spent by the government and much higher taxes to prevent that from being inflationary. It's not obvious to me that's really adding anything to our understanding of the world or the options available to policymakers. So I think modern monetary theory is overhyped. It doesn't really add anything to our understanding of the world. And it certainly doesn't give governments or central banks a free hand to print and spend as much as they would like.
I mean, building on that, we did a podcast recently because the IA did a paper with Juan Castaneda and Forrest Cappy on modern monetary theory. And one of their grievances was that, you know, if you pursue a total modern monetary policy theory, the central bank, it essentially, you know, becomes the treasury, because if the government can say, because there's infinite amounts of money, you can create as infinite amount of money, you know, there's no spending limit whatsoever, and that puts us the independence of the central bank into question.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, at the moment there are some question marks over the independence of central banks, but the way that they've been doing quantitative easing has been a little bit different from what's been happening in the past in countries like Zimbabwe or Venezuela. So central banks haven't been directly financing government spending. What they've been doing instead is buying government bonds from the private sector. Now, I think that's an important distinction, because that is still money that central banks expect to get repaid. And at some point, you know, central banks can sell those bonds back to the private sector. So it's not direct monetary financing. But if we did do direct monetary financing, I think that would be really damaging for two reasons. One is the inflation risk that, you know, obviously governments would have, you know, lots of incentive to print loads of money and spend it, and that would cause inflation. But also that we know that the government is not particularly good at allocating resources in the economy, that, you know, government is pretty inefficient at spending money. There are some things it can do better than the private sector, where there are sort of specific market failures that you can identify. But the risk here is clearly that people think that, you know, just because the government has had to spend and borrow enormous amounts of money during the pandemic, when large amounts of the market economy were shut down, it should continue to do so in future for all sorts of reasons. For example, you know, Green New Deal idea, financing enormous amounts of environmental spending. So you get the result then, I think, would not only be, you know, higher inflation, or at least much higher taxes to prevent that from happening, but it also mean, you know, government intervention in the economy significantly increasing, and that producing the sort of adverse results we see in socialist economies all around the world and throughout history. So I think there are two risks there. There's the monetary risk for inflation, but also there's a broader risk to the efficiency of the economy if the government is starting to be responsible for you know, dominating the economy, for spending enormous amounts of money and making loads of decisions that are actually much better made by private businesses in response to you know, what private consumers and households actually want.
I mean, that's very interesting. I mean, you mentioned the Green New Deal. I mean, do you think direct monetary financing will, you know, or a purist form of modern monetary theory, it will become the norm in the future? Is that a new battleground for people in economics?
Well, I think while it's clearly trendy in, you know, some circles, you know, particularly, you know, left-wing politicians and left-wing economists like this, it's still very much a minority view. And if you talk, for example, to anybody in the Bank of England or the Treasury in the UK, they would be extremely reluctant to go down this route. There was a point last year when the Treasury and the Bank of England agreed to increase the short-term overdraft facility that the Treasury has with the Bank of England, known as the Ways and Means Facility. And lots of people saw that as opening the door to sort of direct monetary financing that some people fear and some people would like. But both the Treasury and the Bank of England were very clear that this was only going to be a temporary arrangement. And in the event, the increase in that overdraft was never actually used. I can see strong arguments on both sides why they would be reluctant to go down this route. From the point of view of the Bank of England, of course, their main job is supposed to be to worry about inflation and financial stability. It's not to finance government spending. And from the point of view of the Treasury and finance ministries generally, of course, they want to maintain fiscal discipline. And if, you know, spending departments thought that central bank will just print whatever amount of money is required to fund whatever, you know, spending projects they've got in mind, then that could be very damaging. So I think there's a strong coalition of interests within the institutions that matter here, you know, central banks and finance ministries, not to go down this route. But it's clearly very popular with politicians, of course, who love the idea that they're going to have a free hand to spend whatever they like. And it's very popular with people on the left, you know, including economists who like the idea of a lot more state intervention in the economy. But hopefully they will, you know, continue to be a minority and we won't go down this route in future.
That's all we've got time for, but thank you, Julian, for a fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe to the IA podcast on Podbean, Spotify or Apple. We also upload our podcast on our YouTube channel, IEA London. If you want to help contribute to the IEA's digital output, please support us on Patreon, where you can benefit from exclusive membership perks whilst helping us continue to produce stimulating educational output. To become an online patron, click the link in the show notes.